Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, earlier on, we heard from Michael Portillo about his new documentary for RTE, Taking Sides, Britain and the Civil War. That'll be on tomorrow night, 9:35, and it gives a British perspective on the Irish Revolution. And among the more eye-opening revelations is the claim that Winston Churchill offered the Provisional Government some converted fighter jets to bombard the forecourts from the air. Inside the forecourts, as we know, a group of anti-treaty rebels had remained holed up with impunity for 2 months. Well, joining me now for his take on all of this is Professor of Modern History at UCD, Diarmaid Ferriter. Good morning.
Morning, Claire. Nice
Very
to
welcome.
See you.
So, what did you make of those revelations? So, we have that one about Winston Churchill and his fighter jets, and then another one about gas grenades, which we'll come to in a moment. The fighter jets first, though.
These aren't hugely surprising. Michael Portillo has a tendency to refer to the documents he uses as extraordinary. And as he says himself in the documentary, he's a Brit coming at this for the first time.
Yeah.
And this is great men history. This is the history of this period as seen through Churchill and senior members of the British government in particular, which is interesting in its own way. But it sometimes loses the wider context there. We have to remember about Churchill. He is a fascinating character and his relationship with Ireland is very interesting. One of his contemporaries, Robert Cecil, suggested that he was only interested in public affairs when there was a prospect of bloodshed. And he's energised by his martial thinking. That's the way he is.
Yeah, well Michael Portillo said himself he was very gung-ho about action without thinking about the consequences afterwards.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. And I suppose what's interesting about, you know, this revelation, for example, about the RAF, that there were various plans around getting the occupants of the forecourts out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have to remember that there were civil servants and Neville Macready, who's mentioned as the commander of the British forces in Ireland, who's still in Ireland with about 6,000 troops, that they were urging greater caution. Their basic idea was that this has to be left to the Irish themselves and we're only going to inflame the situation. Rory O'Connor and his comrades in the forecourts want to embroil the British army because it would serve their wider purposes. So obviously there were those trying to talk Churchill down. But he had asked other questions. Why can't you ring them round and starve them out was another question. And who was he asking those questions of? He was asking Andy Cope. And Andy Cope was the senior British civil servant still in Dublin. He had been part of the Dublin Castle regime and he's there until October 1922. And again, Cope is saying they have to sort this out themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I suppose you could see Churchill as being in a minority. But he's very motivated by the idea of taking a hard line. And there are exaggerations around the idea of what's referred to by Michael Portillo as collusion and zeal when it comes to the relationship between the provisional government and the British government.
But
obviously, they were very reluctant to move against the forecourts occupants. They've been there since the middle of April.
Well, people with sense were, you know, and if you have Cope and you have Macready saying, this is a bad idea for us to get involved, it shows an incredible naivety on the part of Churchill, does it not?
But you see, he's full of melodrama, and I think sometimes you can get caught up in the melodrama contained within the documents because he writes with such flourish. And of course, he had written in April to Michael Collins saying, you must assert yourself or perish and be replaced by some other form of control. So there's always a threat in the background about Britain resuming conflict. And at the same time, he's writing to his wife and he's saying, we don't want to get drawn back in to the bog. He always referred to the bog. They always use that metaphor, or the swamps, as you referred to earlier
yeah.
on. So there are contradictory messages around Churchill's correspondence all the time. That's the nature of the character.
Yeah.
And of course, his relationship with Ireland, he is very much the minister for Irish affairs for the British government at that point. So I'm not for a moment doubting his importance, but there are a lot of other things going on that don't get much of a look in this documentary. And I appreciate, you know, this is the medium of television. It's difficult to do justice to the context. But what was really bothering Michael Collins an awful lot during this period about Churchill was that he wasn't doing enough about what was happening to the Catholic minority in Northern Ireland and that relationship between the British government and James Craig. And, you know, that's a very important part of what yeah. was going on in 1922.
And then can we talk about that other revelation in the documentary? So that Michael Portello and his team found a response from the British government, they say, to a request for gas grenades. Now, we haven't seen the request. Yeah. And that isn't...
And you quite rightly asked about the provenance of that document. Now, I hadn't heard of this before, and it's quite shocking. But there's also the use of language. It was intimated, according to the part of the document that was read out, it was intimated that the Free State government were looking for gas grenades to assist them in the clearing of the forests.
Yep.
Where did that request come from? Was it intimated? What did intimated mean? Was this a discussion between senior officials? Was this an informal exchange? How did it find its way onto the cabinet record? There's a lot of vagueness around that. But nonetheless, you know, that is quite shocking. It does suggest, of course, a degree of desperation, but also it could have been generated as a result of some kind of informal exchange.
Informal exchange, yeah, because they went to the bother of discussing the Washington Convention as a reason why, which wasn't even in force yet, but this is a reason why we wouldn't do this. Yeah. And then the suggestion is that they send some form of tear gas. Then they didn't tell the provisional government that that had arrived. It's extraordinary.
But you see, it's chaotic. Yeah. And I mean, when you consider the summer of 1922, there is chaos. You know, there isn't clarity about how this is going to pan out. And even Michael Collins himself, you know, once the decision is made to attack the forecourts, he becomes very decisive, and he wanted a short war. He wanted them to be routed. And he did believe that this could be over quickly. And they are very willing, of course, to take as much support from Britain and armaments for Britain as they can. But in the flurry of exchanges that are going on, there is a lot of confusion and there is a lot of chaos. And that's the nature of the Irish question for the British government in 1922. But what we shouldn't forget either is that Ireland was just one part of a wider imperial jigsaw. Like, David Lloyd George is on the ropes during this period, not just because of what's going on in Ireland, what's going on in relation to possible war with Turkey, because, you know, Turkey are pushing Greek troops out of Allied territory. There's a lot of tension around that. The High Commission in Iraq is taking up a lot of time as well. When you go over to the archives in London, you realise how insignificant the Irish question is in overall terms, albeit one that was commanding attention and a lot of attention at specific periods. But the real desire is to try and get it off the agenda.
A couple of things that Michael Portello says that I want to ask you about. Here is history that Irish people may prefer not to know. And then he talks about the zeal of the pro-treaty provisional government in accepting British assistance at the start of the Civil War. Now, is that exaggerated?
Well, it's patronising to tell us, here is history that you might not like to hear. You know, and I mean, he makes the point,
but
he's a Tory
but
grandee.
But it can be uncomfortable to hear.
No, it can be uncomfortable.
Doctor.
And to his credit, you know, I mean, he has done four of these programmes now.
Yeah.
And he's often made the point that there's a huge ignorance in Britain about Irish history. Sometimes I feel these documentaries should be broadcast on the BBC as well as RTE. But we don't need to be told, Michael, thank you very much, that this is going to be difficult for us to hear. It's not difficult for us to hear. We're very engaged with that history, particularly now in the centenary year. So, you know, that question of tone, and he addressed that in the interview as well. I mean, in fairness to him, he's conscious of how sensitive this is. But there's nothing shocking in that archive of 1922 in London when you consider minds that are saturated with imperialism. You know, they're of that age, they're of that mindset. So it's interesting to think about what motivated them in terms of how they express themselves about
it. So we're not shocked then by the zeal that the provisional government pursued assistance from the British.
Well, you see, I would probably take issue with the word zeal. I think a lot in the provisional government, you know, there's a huge pressure on them, obviously, and they're deeply resentful that they've been put into this position. But the fact that they held off for so long is a reminder that there were various attempts in the first half of 1922 to prevent this until they felt that a point had been reached. And of course, there was the assassination of Henry Wilson, which is covered there as well, and the declaration by Lloyd George that this is connected to the men in the forecourts. It wasn't. There's also the assertion that Collins and Churchill came to like each other.
Yeah.
Rubbish.
Well, I watched the documentary and I thought there was ambiguity around that.
They hated each other.
Yeah, I thought there was ambiguity.
They hated each other.
Because When Collins died, Churchill moved on like lightning.
Well, it's business as usual. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's no depth, obviously, to that relationship. There has been a suggestion that there was some kind of temperamental affinity between the two men. You know, they really came to loathe each other. And loathe is the word that is used by the biographers and Michael Collins when it comes to Churchill. So you can take that with a pinch of salt. And you also have that reference to Churchill's memoirs when he records this assertion, supposed assertion by Michael Collins, tell Winston that we couldn't have achieved any of this without him. Again, you know, Churchill had a history of attempting to douse fires that he himself had started. And of course, he's writing his memoirs for himself, for his legacy, for posterity. He includes what suits his narrative. He leaves out what doesn't. There were 17,000 Irish men killed in Suvla Bay in 1917 when he was first Lord of the Admiralty. So his engagement with the Irish is a very interesting and difficult one. But again, you can take those kind of assertions with a pinch of salt. The same with the idea that the Laveries, Sir John Lavery and his wife Hazel, you know, that the treaty was more or less negotiated and concluded in their house in London. Again, this is anecdotal. It's not backed up by any serious evidence. And again, it's part of the colour and the texture of the way in which stories are passed down and the way they find their way into narrative accounts. But
when you say there that Churchill tried to douse the fires that he set, that brings me back to what we hear in the documentary about him asking for that document to be destroyed that he had prepared for once this bombing of the forecourts had happened, that this document was ready.
Hats off
to the civil servants, yes.
Because you see, the civil servants recognise that they are responsible for keeping an accurate record of what transpired. And Neville Macready referred to the feverish impetuosity of Winston Churchill. Macready, as commander of the British forces in Ireland, hated the Irish, and he was very upfront about his detestation of the Irish. But the way he put it was that he was fed up with those ignorant in London while he was in Dublin, realising that if they were to follow through the suggestions of Churchill, they'd be in even greater trouble. And this was an example, this proclamation that Macready effectively ignored. He was paying for time. It was the right thing to do, obviously. But Churchill was conscious once again that this could complicate the way in which he wanted to present the story. So he's very quick to get his private secretary to ring Maurice Hankey. And of course, Maurice Hankey confers with Lionel Curtis, who's another very important civil servant who was in the Colonial Office advising on Irish affairs.
And do you think that there is any possibility that there would be Irish records that we don't know about that might substantiate that request, the allegation of the request for the gas?
Well, we have not seen every document relating to the Irish Civil War. And this is always the case when it comes to historical research. You have to be very careful of asserting that we now have the definitive record. We don't have the definitive record. Something may well emerge. And again, it shouldn't surprise us. We have to understand the depth of the feelings of both vulnerability and anger in Ireland in 1922. And it did force people to consider things that they would have thought horrendous the previous year. And they're also, it's also the climate. You know, we have to be conscious of how conflict was viewed and how options were viewed and the pressures that existed in 1922. And it's not about excusing terrible things that happened. It's about trying to understand the context for them. Much is made of the idea of Kevin O'Higgins signing the death warrants when it came to the executions.
Yeah.
Again, you know, that's a difficult legacy that has to be confronted.
It is, but we have to imagine what it would have been like coming out of a war of independence into a civil war and what they were potentially facing.
But those bodies meant nothing to the British government. And when you consider the speed with which Stanley Baldwin, for example, who takes over after David Lloyd George, asserts that he doesn't want the Irish question coming near his table. He doesn't want it discussed in the House of Commons. Ramsay MacDonald after him is like that as well. And this I find is interesting, arising out of what is an interesting documentary, that the real message from Ireland in 1922, from the British government's perspective, is that we don't want to go back to the Irish crisis. It's been dominating our politics for far too long. It's referred to as a fatal influence at one point by one of the senior Tories. But Lord Salisbury, another senior Conservative, also makes the point that the average English voter has little interest in and even less understanding of the Irish question. And he made that assertion in 1924. And that resonates down through the decades. But part of the reason why there was this lack of interest was because of what happened in 1922. We've got to get ourselves out of the bog for good. But they don't.
I'm sure people who watched the documentary will note that moment as well, where both Lloyd George and Winston Churchill thought that once the treaty was signed, wipe the hands, that's it now, that's done, sorted. And that's they believed that.
They did believe that. And I mean, this is one of the reasons why it's been so interesting in recent years, that obviously Britain looms much larger in Irish consciousness than Ireland does in British consciousness. And that was very telling during recent controversies about Brexit and about the border. And they had to go back, or some of them at least, had to go back to this period of history, including Michael Portillo, who is a Brexiteer. But I presume he would accept now that you can't understand these recent or contemporary controversies without having some awareness of what went on in 1922 and 1923, both from the British and the Irish perspective.
And that's why it would be a good idea, as you say, to show those documentaries in Britain on the BBC. Thank you very much, Dermot, for coming in. That's Professor Dermot Ferriter. And Taking Sides, Britain and the Civil War, to be broadcast on RT1 tomorrow night at 9:35 p.m. Well worth a watch. We'll take a break.